This is the McKinsey Podcast, where we help you make sense out of our world's toughest business challenges.
Welcome to the show. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Most businesses are being disrupted in some form today. And as an organization, if you're not clear on how you're building new muscles to compete differently, odds are you're going to be left behind.
That's McKinsey's Chief Client Officer, Liz Hilton Siegel, on a recent episode of our webinar series, McKinsey Live. Liz joined me and Homion Hatami, Managing Partner for Global Client Capabilities, to talk about the most pressing issues CEOs are facing right now.
In our second segment, there's something new to stress about. It's microstress. Find out how to cope with it from Rob Cross, author of the book, The Microstress Effect: How Little Things Pile Up and Create Big Problems, and What to Do About It, from our Author Talk series.
Liz, Homion, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Liz, Homion, the three of us spoke a little more than a year ago on McKinsey Live about what was top of mind for CEOs at that juncture. And then, in 2023, the operating environment just seemed beleagueringly tough. But in 2024, it's really not a whole lot simpler. It hasn't really been a year of reprieve for leaders. Homion, what has changed the most for CEOs?
Obviously, all of the CEOs we have talked to are grateful for the opportunities and the lives they have. Yet it's fair to say, as you said it, that it has become a much more difficult time to lead. We are dealing with an endless series of crises. There are two major conflicts. There is suffering in many parts of the world. There are upcoming elections in many countries. There are concerns about the global economy, with performances varying across different pockets. And there is hesitation and hope around technology. I find the CEOs in this context to be humble. They know it's important to lead with empathy and humanity. Now, you ask what's new. I think one of the biggest issues impacting business today is geopolitics. The world has been connected economically, yet there is fragmentation more and more. There are competing interests amongst the US, Europe, and China when it comes to technology platforms, and we can keep going on. But it's fair to say that geopolitics has moved away from being the remit of the chief risk officers and government affairs to take the center stage on the agenda of CEOs and the boards. Perhaps the story of the last year, or the story of the decade, perhaps we are still not done with it, is technology and notably Gen AI. We saw just a year ago the launch of a very powerful Gen AI tools. Today we are seeing a shift from pilots to rollout, enterprise-wide rollout, with an explosion of use cases across every industry as companies try to figure out how to make the most out of Gen AI while managing the risk. These disruptions means that CEOs will have to lead in a new way.
Many organizations, as you alluded to, are also launching their own proprietary Gen AI tools to manage for some of the risks. Liz, how should CEOs be thinking about Gen AI and how to start now making the most of its potential?
To put it in context, the McKinsey Global Institute estimates that generative AI could be worth more than $4 trillion of value. So it's something that everyone is talking about constantly. Our annual survey that we do, we asked folks, to what degree is generative AI in use in your organization today? And a third of them said it already was, and at least in one business function. And that's in contrast to about half of them will describe AI in use in one function in some form. And so this is absolutely already in use and also very much something that people are investing in going forward. And I think people are wondering, where will I get the greatest value out of it? And they're wondering what changes will be necessary. Is this just about technology and new analytics, or is this about more fundamental change in our entire organization? And I think our view is certainly that it is about more fundamental change in the entire organization. To give you one example, last fall, we worked with the bank ING. ING has over 30 million customers around the world. They are in 40 countries. And so we just simply started in one country. We started in the Netherlands with them. And we looked at how could they get a customer-facing chatbot working. And in less than 2 months, we had it up and running. They already then had about 20% of their customers seeing a lower wait time and better answer to their questions. And then they were able to take the step to start rolling it out all over the world.
So our research has shown, historically at least, that most digital transformations, including some AI-driven transformations, fail to deliver the expected impact. Why is this? And what can leaders do here to actually realize that impact and drive performance?
Despite all the investments, we estimate that companies on average have captured less than a third of the full potential they should expect from their digital transformation. And we are seeing the distance between the leaders and the laggards getting bigger. Leaders are pulling ahead because they are building hard-to-copy capabilities. They know it's not just about tech. It's a lot about change management. They know it's not just about what some CEOs call snackable AI featurettes. It's about transformative AI that will build superpowers for their people and for their company. The compounding effect of Gen AI and digital happen when CEOs rewire their organization. And to do that, we see them do six things. First, they adopt a digital roadmap that is business-led, not feature-led. They ensure they have the right talent. They adopt an operating model that can scale from the get-go. This is not just about the pilot. You have to have the end state rollout and the scaling in mind. They make technology easier for people to use. This is about making the life of employees and colleagues and customers easier. They put experience at the heart of change. They use data, they embed data everywhere, and they focus their leadership and their investments on adoption and enterprise scaling. Here at McKinsey, we are using Gen AI to give our people superpowers. A year ago, we launched Lily. Lily is our own private Gen AI solution. We have made it integral to the way we work. We are training our colleagues on it, and we are changing our colleagues' behavior. And from day one, we ran it with the idea of full-scale adoption.
Okay, let's pivot now to a different priority. Geopolitical tensions have been escalating. And that introduces significant risk for companies, especially those that are operating internationally, obviously. And 2024 is a major election year, not just in the US, where Liz and I are, but globally. Folks in more than 70 countries are heading to the polls over the next 12 months. Liz, how should CEOs be planning in order to navigate this really intensifying geopolitical uncertainty?
For business, geopolitical risk is really center stage, and especially for the CEO, their teams, and the boards. What we are advising our clients to do is build both geopolitical muscle and bone. Geopolitical muscle is all about the capabilities of the executive and the board, and the kinds of decisions that the executive team and the boards might be addressing would be things like what their supply chain footprint is and how they want to think about flexibility and resilience in their supply chain footprint. It might also be about how they approach investments in new markets and how they evaluate those investments relative to the risk and return of them. It could also certainly be about technology bets they make and the technology architecture that they have in their organization. And in terms of bone, what we mean by that is creating a set of processes and systems that allow for geopolitically informed decision-making as the context of the world changes, and so that there's adaptability.
Homayoun, last year we talked about the energy transition requiring the biggest reallocation of capital we expect to see in our lifetime, and costs only seem to be rising. Climate is obviously a complex question. It varies by geography, it varies by sector and so forth. But talk to us at a high level about what leaders should be thinking about and how they might act to help speed the transition to net zero.
Climate change is the generation-defining challenge for all of us. To make the equation more complicated, I think at least in Europe, the recent energy crisis has demonstrated to us that we need to go after actually four interdependent objectives and not just one. We need to reduce the emissions. We need to improve affordability. We need to have energy security. And we need to marry all of that with industrial competitiveness. So we have to run two energy systems in parallel. On the one hand, we have to scale the new zero or low carbon energy system. There were lots of commitments at COP. Folks committed to triple renewables by 2030, to double the energy efficiency improvement rates, and to establish new standards to enable the global trade in hydrogen. At the same time, on the other hand, we have to accelerate the decarbonization of existing systems. For example, that was a big part of the discussion in COP. Estimates suggest that emissions of methane from oil and gas operations could be reduced by 30% at no or nearly no net cost. Of course, the next step is to translate that into measurable actions. Financing will play a big part in the resolution of this equation. There is a $41 trillion funding gap. Addressing this gap, of course, is critical because the technologies for net zero are largely available today. There are some estimates that suggest that 90% of the carbon abatement that needs to happen could be achieved using already proven technologies. But of course, we need to have the funding and we need to focus on adoption. In the meantime, adaptation is critical, and we are seeing countries and companies take real action on health, on water, on food, and on nature. But to answer your question, when it comes to the actions leaders should take, I would say perhaps the most important is to frame these choices and these trade-offs as an and. We should be able to reduce emissions and do it in an economic way and making sure there is affordability and security. We estimate that by 2030, demand for green technologies could generate up to $12 trillion in annual revenues. And so this capital reallocation will happen and will have to happen in part through growth and in capturing business opportunities.
Liz, let's talk about growth. What can leaders do today to realize their growth ambitions? And by extension, to outperform in a more consistent and sustainable and durable way?
This has been really an extraordinary period. You know, the sort of 20, 21, 22, 23 is certainly something I've never seen. Imagine you're an executive and you run a company and you got yourself through a cyber crisis where, because of geopolitics, you had a cyber attack and you barely were able to hold on to your website that's central to your revenue trajectory. Then you handled major commodity price increase, and then you handled a supply chain disruption, and then you turn around and say, oh, wait a minute, I have to also grow. And so it has been a very tricky period. It's when we say these things kind of intellectually, it's hard to absorb what it feels like when you're somebody who has to actually navigate all of these things all at once. And so when we look at it, what we find is that folks that have been able to continue to both grow from the top line point of view, outpacing their peers, and also maintain profit growth, only one in four companies do that. And so we went ahead and just looked at, from the point of view of holding up that top line while you're still growing the bottom line, what are six strategies you can pursue. And so just to mention two maybe that stand out the most, one is really, how are you going about building a culture of growth, a mindset of growth, and a culture of innovation? And we have found that companies that truly master innovation excellence will typically see 4 points more of TSR growth than other outperformers. So really ingraining within your organization a culture and mindset of growth and innovation is quite important. And then the second thing is, 80% of most companies' reported growth comes from the core of their business. And so asking yourself the question, where will I get incremental growth from the core? And how specifically can I leverage all the things we talked about earlier? How can I leverage data? How can I leverage analytics? How can I leverage AI? And potentially how I leverage changes to the way in which my organization approaches technology? How do all these things come together to create new pathways for growth in your organization? These things don't come easy, but I think that we do find that the organizations that put more attention to it and more commitment to it do see outsized performance.
Let's shift gears a bit. Talk to us about what our research says about how leaders should prioritize their middle managers in this particular environment.
The best CEOs we see will do everything in their power to actually keep the best middle managers or managers exactly where they are, and to reward them and to focus them on coaching and connecting people, because that is their single most value add. They try to elevate the role of middle managers by giving them the space and the time to coach and to lead. This is, for example, very important in sales. Sales managers should have the time to coach. That's what, you know, they are there to do. If they are worried about making their individual quota as opposed to the team quota, then they're going to get into an individualistic behavior and not coach everyone. And so the goal here is to lift everyone. The other thing the CEOs do is they make the managers the customer of change. For the managers to be your best allies, you have to co-create change with them. You have to co-create, make them embrace the roadmap, the why, the story of change. And this is how you can get the most out of this vital group in an organization.
Liz, we also talk about what we call superpowers. That's a positive word. It's a powerful word. But what are we actually talking about when we use that term in an organizational context?
Every company needs to know what is their superpower today. What is uniquely true about their skill set and competencies as an organization that enables them to have competitive advantage? And what or how do those capabilities need to change? Most businesses, most industries are being disrupted in some form today. So whether that is disruption from a digital attacker, whether that is the business becoming more software-led, but there is change coming everywhere. And as an organization, if you're not clear on how you're building new muscles to compete differently, odds are you're going to be left behind. And so if you just take examples of this, like if you think of LVMH, the owners of, you know, Louis Vuitton as an example, their superpower is all around quality and craftsmanship in the just truly superior products that they have. Or folks in the B2B space might know Danaher, which is very much known for the Danaher business system as being very central to how they have created value over time. So companies have a core of how they have historically competed and created value for their shareholders. And the question is should those things shift? And if so, how do they shift? And my point of view is that for any executive team, you should be ready and having a dialogue with your board about how those capabilities might change. And an example that we see quite broadly is if you think of the financial services industry, so our banks and our credit card companies and so forth, these are both industries that really need software as a superpower going forward. Because when you look at how competition is occurring, so much more of what drives a consumer buying decision is the way in which they're presenting basically software to the consumer in the form of a consumer experience, whether that's in an electric vehicle or whether that's in a digital experience that you might use to interact with your bank. And so part of the superpower that we're helping them to develop is the software product management capability that's required to compete in a new way. And so naming what superpower you want to have as part of it, but then actually mapping out that journey to go from where you are today to a new future is where all the fun is.
Liz and Omiyun, you must talk to hundreds of CEOs over the course of a year. What are some of the qualities that help make for a great leader, particularly in today's times? Omiyun, let's start with you.
When people think about the job of the CEO, they typically think about charting a vision for the company, you know, interacting and managing the board, being visible to stakeholders, fielding tough questions, so on and so forth, pushing hard for results. And of course, these are attributes and behaviors that we all expect from a CEO. But there is another layer of behaviors that is not always seen and arguably has much to do with the success of these leaders. Here, we are talking about the micro habits that will help the leaders stay zen, be inspired, have energy so that in turn they can inspire others. These could be things like holding the line on travel, capping the length of meetings, not checking email after 8 p.m., or picking up the phone and talking to someone instead of thinking about an eloquent prose, you know, on email. It could also be going for a walk instead of doing a one-on-one. What we are seeing with Liz is that as a leader, the best way and perhaps the only way to take good care of your teams, your customers, your stakeholders, is to start by taking good care of yourself.
I had the opportunity to interview Andy Jassy and just asked him for leadership at the scale of Amazon, you know, which whose revenues is like the size of the GDP of Sweden or Thailand and has the employee population, I think, of like Philadelphia or Dallas. So it's just an extraordinary organization in size. What does he look for? And he talked about people leadership, but then he talked about learning. We think about all the things we talked about today. what they all require is an open mind towards learning and really building new knowledge and new capabilities. So I would leave you that one, Lucia.
Liz and Homiyun, always so great. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Next up, microstress. What it is and how to soothe it, from author Rob Cross.
Microstress is different than conventional forms of stress, where we think of large things that are hitting us or antagonistic relationships. The reality is microstress can actually come at us, and often does, through people we love and care about. The hard part that I think is shifted today, and especially through COVID, is the collaborative footprint of almost everything we do has shot up. What we're seeing is that we are hit with 20, 25, 30, sometimes more of these micro stresses and small moments. We're conditioned to kind of fight through, but our bodies absorb it. And the stress affects metabolically how we process foods. There's a great study done that showed that when you're under this form of stress, you eat the same meal and the way your body metabolizes that meal, you add 200 plus calories with the stress. We're all talking about the burnout rate, right? And how exhausted everybody is. But the exact flip side of the coin is we've never had more ability to shape what we do and who we do it with. And yet we give it up very quickly. There's five of these interactions that tend to drain capacity. I'll grab one and it's small misses from teammates. And what I mean is it's not so much the big slacker on our teams. What's happening a lot of times today is that people are not on just one team, right? They may have one primary team, but then they're put on five, six, seven other efforts, right? And so if you happen to own one of those efforts, and let's just say there's four people on your effort with you, and those four, because they're under pressure, come back 95% done. They seem like small misses, but four people times 5% each means a 20% impact on you. What you need to do is have mechanisms in place that hold that accountability in a way that doesn't say you have to go to each of those people individually. And so we see small things like restating expectations, make sure that people are clear on commitments that they're coming back to, opening the following meeting, right, with a quick summary of where are you against where we planned. What you're trying to do is avoid that slow slippage, right, of commitment. There is a definite tendency for women to absorb more of the collaborative demands than men over time. That creates conditions for greater micro stress in all these touch points that create that stress. That strategy of find someone that you can shield against, find someone to stop causing, and find someone to start rising above. It's that third strategy that really matters the most. Find ways to rise above. And so you can chip away at some of it, but you also have to kind of take control of life. The happier people have at least two and usually three groups they're an authentic part of outside of their profession. If you fall in other groups, one is to reflect back on a passion you had in the past and use that to slingshot you into a new group. Or number two, reach back to ties that have become dormant, you know, college friends, and kind of find ways to reignite them. The biggest thing I really learned through this work is the people that went through large transitions went into that saying, I'm just going to master the job first. And when I get that done, then I'm going to become myself again. And I'm going to reinvest in the things that kept me human and whole. And they never did. They became, over time, narrower and narrower versions of themselves. In contrast, I saw people that would go through those transitions, and despite all common sense, they would lean into it and say, you know, I'm going to get the job right, but I'm also going to invest heavily in the community here. And everybody that did that well, they just discovered different things that brought them joy. They just kept greater dimensionality in their lives. They used small moments to live more richly with other people. Typically, it's the small micro moments are the answer as well as the problem in different ways.
Thanks so much for listening to the McKinsey Podcast. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Find us on McKinsey.com. We'll have a transcript of this episode up shortly.
And download the McKinsey Insights app, where you can find this podcast and other helpful content updated daily.
If you enjoyed the show, we'd love for you to leave a rating and a review.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.